Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, it is my special privilege today to introduce to you one of the most charismatic civil and economic rights leaders of this century, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jackson will speak to us on rebirth of a nation. Reverend Jackson.
Thank you, Mrs. Colliver, members of the dais, brothers and sisters here gathered. I consider it an honor to have had the invitation extended to me to address this esteemed body today and to participate in dialogue after the speech. Amongst other things, I am also a country preacher. And I want to share with you a few verses of scripture that gives some base from where I am coming. St. John, the 3rd chapter, the 1st through the 7th verses. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. The same came to Jesus by night and said unto him, Rabbi, we know that thou art a teacher come from God, but no man can do these miracles that thou doest except God be with him. And Jesus answered and said unto him, Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot even see the kingdom of God. And Nicodemus said unto him, How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter the second time into his mother's womb and be born? And Jesus answered, Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. And so marvel not that I say you must be born again. Speaking before a group such as this group, marvel not that I say that fundamentally America needs to be born again. We come at a period approaching the bicentennial of this nation where we assess where we have come from and we assess where we are going. And I argue that the most fundamental need in America today is to be reborn, the rebirth of a nation. Not to deal with just being 200 years old and starting all over again. We were once born of the water. Any baby in its mother's womb is in water. So all of us have already been born of the water. America has already been born as a nation 200 years ago. But there's a rebirth of the spirit of the nation that must take place again. There's nothing wrong with our money and our matter and our established institutions theoretically, except there's something terribly wrong with our attitude. It is not your aptitude, but your attitude that determines your altitude. The set of your mind determines your greatness. It determines the heights that you climb to. This very rich ruler who came to meet with the rabbi, who came to meet with the teacher by night, representing the Pharisaic tradition, had all of the legalism on his side. He had all of the rituals. And our nation has all of the ritualism and all of the legalism. If one wants to deal with health in this nation from a ritualistic point of view, there is a health department. However, people are sick. There is a housing department. However, people are ill housed. There is a board of education. However, people are not being educated. There is an unemployment office. However, people are unemployed. There are banks. However, people cannot get money. And so in some sense, likened unto the Pharisee, we have all of the rituals and all of the notions and
all of the motions and the institutions, but something more fundamental than that which we see is missing in the nation today. As we approach the bicentennial, all of us agonize at the state of the nation. We have our various opinions about the guilt and the innocence of persons in high positions in Washington, except one thing that all of us can agree to is that the nation today is in disgrace, and the nation is in shame. And it's not enough to self-righteously hide behind your set of reasons. The sum total of the matter is we are trapped in a severe moral-civilizational crisis. We use very simplistic assessments. We say the nation is in an urban crisis because of what's happening in major cities. And we are in an urban crisis, but more than that, we say we are in a racial crisis, and we are, but it's more than that. We say that we are in a crisis of the sexes, and we are, but it's more than that. We say there's a generation gap, but that's not the only gap. And when you pull all of these crises together, what one has is a civilizational crisis. Bigger than any rich man's purse, bigger than any ethnic dominant group's righteousness. And to that extent, we will either deal with the crisis in true perspective or fall prey to the law of general ruination and become one of the great nations that died. We have become preoccupied with Nixon. We must become occupied with him. He's the president, but not preoccupied, inasmuch as the absence of Nixon is not the presence of justice. The absence of Nixon is not the presence of balance. The nation's ills will not be cured with simply the negation of him and some kind of two-year substitute. We are in a civilizational crisis. Dr. and Mrs. Charles Beard, some years ago, attempting to size up their studies as great world and economic historians, what they saw as the problem. How could they size up the rise and fall of civilizations? And they reduced all of their writings and studies and travels the four very witty statements. Statements often used but must be seen in a new light. One, they said that the mills of the gods grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly small. And from the foot of this nation where lies were told and slavery existed and cards were pushed under the table, the mills of the gods grind slowly, but they've finally gotten to the head of the nation, and they are grinding exceedingly small. Secondly, whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. And to be in the White House and its environs, breaking in the office of psychiatrists, violating people's basic liberties, is the work of people who have gone mad, and their madness, not the body politic, not the military, not the established business institution, not the hippies, but their madness is driving them out of office. Thirdly, the ordinary honeybee feeds the flower that he robs. And when the wealthy of this nation is more willing to invest abroad than to protect the laborers on whose backs they stand, they are not exercising the sense of the ordinary honeybee. When we are willing to overspend the military budget by $27 billion, which would completely wipe out unemployment if applied adequately, and would rebuild most American cities, we are not exercising the judgment of the ordinary honeybee. And lastly, when it is dark enough, you can see the stars. And it is at that level that even in the darkness, darkness can never be fully declared until we allow our lights to go out. And everybody has a light. And as long as there's a light, there's hope. As long as there's hope, there's possibility. And that is the pinhead of optimism on which we stand today, our own light. The attitude of the nation determines its course. The Constitution is our legal attitude put on paper. The Statue of Liberty and the words inscribed represent our social attitude. Give me your tithe, give me your poor, give me your huddled masses. We love people. There's things for people to do. Give us the dispossessed. That was the great national attitude, capital of the free world. Not the world's police with a military, but the world's savior with an attitude. But now our attitude has gone wild. People in power project the notion that poor people have a nature that is inferior to rich people. Not their circumstance, that their nature is different. The same kind of incentives that are provided for the wealthy are self-righteously and viciously taken away from the have-nots. When Mr. Reagan did not pay taxes and Mr. Nixon did not pay taxes, they said, these are basically good men, but the tax system is wrong. The tax system has loopholes. Good men, bad system. But when poor people, trapped in an economy where beans have gone up 256%, beef 80%, pork 60%, who do not even have the allocation in their budget for toiletries, use some of that money to make ends meet. They say there's a good system, but they're bad people. Good system, bad people, when applied to the poverty stricken. That is questioning the very nature of poor people. It goes into the nature of God and theology. The rebirth of a nation. A new attitude. Many people have lost the desire to see black and white people relate in a civilized fashion. Many people have lost the urge for full employment. Many people have lost the urge for a uniform public educational system. That's all that the Detroit busing case was about. Up to 1954, you were deprived of the best education in America based on race, skin color. As of 1974, you're deprived of the best education based on class, based on neighborhood, citizenship. Not suburbs or inner city. Citizenship should be the basis for getting the best education that the nation has to offer. And unless and until that happens, the poor have a right to march and or be bussed and or fly to the superior schools. We fight wars together. We pay taxes together. We should be educated together. But we have to be born again to even see that as civilized. It is not enough to go into 1976 fighting for welfare. We must see welfare as a failure of the economic system, not the people. We don't want and need welfare. We need a full employment economy. We need an alternative to welfare. No people are legitimately striving to be on welfare. People need to work. And work needs people. Suburban housewife and the inner city mother, both of them come up awfully empty. One getting a check from her husband, the other getting it from the state, but neither one has the glory and the reward of wholesome work. People need to work. That's fulfillment in work. But people need to get paid for the work that they do and need to be respected as they engage in socially useful work. What is fundamentally bad about the welfare system is that the economists who designed it were not as intelligent as they have been projected to be. For that present welfare system is an endless cycle that does not have built into it the incentive to earn or to learn. If you're on welfare getting $200 a month, and you go out and make $200 a month, they take the whole $200. So you say, why work? The incentive to earn is destroyed. You make a dollar, they take a dollar. If you're on welfare in the 10th grade, and you go back to night school to get a degree, which increases your ability to go into the labor market, chances are you'll be put off of welfare and discouraged. So there's no incentive to earn or to learn. The system is bad. Say this and I close. We must be of service without being servile, because service is power, and that's fundamental. We must glory in work and production. Somehow the sense of craftsmanship in America has gone low because of the total alienation between production and the producers. Lastly, there must be some major detente and summit meetings within the nation between her many ethnic groups. Black people and Jewish people have been together too long to allow their relationships to just disintegrate without having at least a summit meeting. Black people and Arab people need to sit down and have a summit meeting. We need to have a detente between Chicano Americans and Black Americans and White Americans. We need to clean up our own house. Be born again of the Spirit and have an earnest desire to have a better nation. The Defunas versus Odegaard case drew some rather official battle lines between those of us who need quota and affirmative action for our survival. Some of the people who marched hand in hand with us on Southern social issues are now taking that money, taking us to Supreme Court, fighting affirmative action, the quota, which is the only objective standard by which we can measure our economic progress. With that, I suggest, members of this club, let us earnestly seek a new nation. Let us seek a new peace. Let us develop a uniform educational system that will educate all of our children. Let us obliterate hunger and starvation. We have the capacity if we have the will. Let us learn to love and respect each other. Let us reduce the military budget. Stop the killing abroad. Start the healing at home. Let us be that great nation that God called us into existence to be. A nation that would advocate studying the law no more, beating swords in the plowshares, and declaring the glory of the Lord. That's our possibility. That is our hope. We will not be able to accept such a challenge unless we have the courage of our convictions. Let us diagnose the case accurately. Let us prescribe the remedy, however painful. And let us have the discipline the follow through for the nation's sake. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Jackson, for reminding us of our common humanity and for shaking us up. There are a great many questions that have come to our President, Vernon Gooden, which he will pose to you now.
Thank you, Edith. And Dr. Jackson, if you will return to the podium, there are a number of questions, and we'll get started right away. You mentioned the quota system, and we have several questions, of which I'll ask two. Isn't there a real difference between quotas for some and affirmative action for all? And the other question, how can we enforce quotas for certain groups without discriminating against others?
Okay, isn't there a real difference between quotas for some and affirmative action for all? The quotas has been the most workable formula for overcoming the historical discrimination. Heretofore, the nation has accepted no official responsibility for the discrimination with a program of compensation. We must not forget that the nation does stand guilty of having enslaved a people on this soil and must assume the responsibility of opening up the doors of opportunity for the persons who were legally locked out and be willing to do whatever is necessary to give them the opportunity to catch up. The way that one gets away from what is considered quotas for some and affirmative action for others is by having a full employment economy where it does not really matter who gets the job because the quota is absolute. So long as there is unemployment at 4% and 5% as a rather chronic level, where some people are deranged enough to think that that amount of unemployment is necessary to stimulate people to work, we will always have the quota affirmative action dialogue. But as a black people, we must fight for a minimal quota and affirmative action. Historically, we were put with a quota. That quota was zero. We got a quota in baseball managers today. Got a quota in football league quarterbacks. And we got quotas of zero in too many high places. So it is to our distinct advantage to demand, in as much as we are naturally capable of doing that which other people do, to have some objective measurement for determining this nation's commitment to overcome its historical discrimination.
Next question is on the Urban League. It says the Urban League goal is full employment. Is this a realistic goal? What time frame do you envision, and what is the push role in connection with it?
Well, the Urban League states for its convention theme full employment, but really this was the theme of the 1946 Congress, a goal of full employment. And the question is not whether or not it is a realistic goal coming from Urban League, but does the Congress intend to be true to the law of 1946 that's already on its book? The other part of the question is, how much will it cost us for people not to work? How much will it cost us for people not to be educated? How much will it cost us for people not to be healthy? I submit that uneducated people cost more to keep up. I submit that unemployed people cost more to keep up. Right now, we have the ability, if we redefine work and make the rebuilding of American cities our goal, we can make full employment effective immediately.
Are you striving for minority employment in small businesses as well as the large corporations? Is publicity with regard to unemployment or employment in big business its main attraction?
Well, I think we're applying for employment at all levels. First of all, our goal is a full employment economy. Now, whether the government employs us, major business employs us, minor business, or self-employment, the goal is full employment economy. I would suggest that all sectors of the business and governmental community must come together to put forth such a plan. But my chief argument today is, unless that is the will, unless that is the spirit, unless that is the commitment to do it, then we will develop all kinds of reasons on why it can't be done.
What percent of government budgets are designed to help minority business, or what percent of government budgets designed to help minority business actually gets into the hands of minority businessmen?
Well, there's evidence that a relatively small percentage of government budgets designed to help minority business gets into the hands of the minority business people. I think that there is, at this point, no national commitment to develop businesses that are led and headed up by persons who are in various ethnic groups who are presently locked out. And some of Watergate reveals that a lot of the money that came in the so-called black capitalism program was used for political ends. It was used more for payoffs than for development. That persons almost had to belong to the Republican re-elect President Nixon campaign to get a share of that money. And there was hardly any relationship between the building of legitimate businesses who needed the money and where the money actually got to.
What are your thoughts on federal cutbacks to community programs?
Well, I think it's horrible. That's the answer to that. And I think it's clearer every day that the last priority on the nation's agenda is that of poor people. And I again argue that that which made us great in the sight of people the world over is that the very attitude of America relative to poor people is what made it great. In many instances, America did not offer help to people, but its attitude offered hope to people. Now, in many instances, our money, which is designed to offer help to people, does not gain favor with them because our attitude is so bad, they feel hopeless and unenergized. In other words, neither people nor nations can live by bread alone. This nation must develop a new attitude toward all of its people. We cannot have at the top of the nation a leadership whose mind is not broad enough to encompass the nation. As I often put it, if you give a sergeant an army, he will reduce it to a platoon size of his mind. If you give a general a platoon, he will expand it to the size of an army. People make things fit the size of their minds. And we can no longer get trapped with the wealthiest and most able nation in the world with some of the poorest in spirit and some of the most dispossessed in the mind in high places, though the nation will be poor right down to the level of those in charge.
What effect has Huey Newton and the Panthers have had on the black movement in regard to equal employment, poverty programs, etc.?
I think that perhaps the greatest contribution that Huey Newton and the Panthers had was to expose a certain police community friction. All of our communities have been under military occupation by the police force for a long time. And that was never a substantial movement to really reveal that. There were a few court cases here and there. But since the Panther police confrontations, there's a heightened sensitivity in the whole nation to the use of military power to suppress people. It has now taken on a more palatable form where people are now suing cities for revenue-sharing money to get more blacks in positions of authority, to get more Chicanos in positions of authority in order to reduce the police brutality, in order to reduce the police community crime. But prior to the Panther police confrontation, there was just almost no sensitivity to that as being a very basic and fundamental problem.
We have a number of questions on this subject. One, do you feel that the zebra situation could have been handled better? And if you had been in Mayor Alioto's shoes, how would you have handled the zebra situation for immediate results?
Do you have reference to the rubbing people down in the streets and all that? Well, first of all, I do not think that we can suspend principles of that magnitude for an issue and the emotions of the moment. I think the precedents are too dangerous, and the precedents threaten too many people. I do not think that the mayor was justified in literally suspending the Constitution. I think he gained political favor, but I think he was unjust in doing so. I think, for example, when there was a case of persons who were described as white doing indiscriminate killings, that white persons of a certain stereotypical image were not stopped and harassed and searched in the street. So I think there was a dimension of race involved. I must concede, however, that when people become so alienated from the government that they began to engage in all kinds of bizarre crimes and episodes, it creates very cutting dilemmas. But I certainly think that if we are willing to be patient and to tolerate the president and his men's conduct and not be willing to suspend the Constitution for 1 second, how can we act so rapidly and so hasty upon the poor, the impotent, and the dispossessed? I think our inconsistency is the kind of contradiction that indicts us.
Last evening, you proposed shadow governments at all levels. Are these to operate within or outside of the system? And would you please comment?
Well, first of all, the concept of shadow governments. In England, when one party loses, the other party doesn't go to sleep for the next 4 years. It assumes the responsibility of helping to enforce the check and the balance. We kind of have the effect of if the Democrats lose, the Republicans just lay dead until 4 years later, and vice versa. I think the parties must remain active at all points and times and be able to demand equal time for the purpose of creating structures of accountability. I'm suggesting that poor people and persons who feel alienated, who may not be so poor, who want greater accountability out of government, must organize statewide organizations. Persons interested in education must assume the responsibility of watching the State Board of Education day in and day out. Persons interested in medicine must assume the responsibility of watching AMA and HEW day in and day out, and right on down at every level of government. It is that level of people responsibility that will allow elected officials to know that somebody is overlooking their shoulders. But when those of us who vote or don't vote do not accept the notion of eternal vigilance, then the non-work of good people lays the groundwork for the misdeeds of evil people. And that is really what we mean by shadow government.
Please comment on Charles Evers' endorsement of George Wallace for vice president, and why did less than 50% of the black voters in Georgia go to the polls in the last election? You can dispute any of these facts that are assumed.
Charles Evers on endorsing George Wallace for vice president are saying that he could. My position is, Brother J. Miller, very constitutional. On the other hand, it's moral. That is, constitutionally, he has the right to endorse George Wallace, but morally, it doesn't make him right because he endorses George Wallace. Furthermore, I think that position is a very unrepresentative position. I think that the press tried to impose his announcement and Mr. Ford's on the rest of the nation. Neither the Urban League, nor the NAACP, nor any established civil rights organization, neither the Congressional Black Caucus, nor any mayor from any major city in America, neither any church body or any fraternal order has followed suit. But there has been an attempt to magnify that very personal position. Very frankly, I do not think that the relationship between Evers and Wallace is the case, as much as it is that Evers and some others are very akin to the Kennedys. And some people are trying to make a Kennedy-Wallace ticket palatable. So if some forces in the black community can make the rest of us by George Wallace, then Kendra would be virtually assured of a kind of shoe-in. But I think that the one thing we have learned from the present administration is that we cannot sacrifice character and reputation and symbolism for expediency. Why did less than 50% of the black voters in Georgia go to the polls in the last election? I do not know whether or not that statement is true, but it could very well be there's an awful great amount of voter apathy around the nation, and there's always a relationship between voter turnout and stimulation or motivation in a given campaign. I do know that in the mayor's election in Georgia, more than 50% of the people turned out.
How are you and Mayor Daley getting along, and is Chicago still a good location in which to base your activity?
Mayor and I are getting along just fine. He's moving toward jail, and I'm moving toward freedom. All of the people close to him are being indicted and convicted. And cronyism in Chicago. And his sons are up before the grand jury for having gotten an insurance test rigged. And they have major insurance contracts from the city over which the mayor presides. And that's called nepotism. Plus, a few weeks ago, he had a stroke and has been ill for some weeks now. So we're getting along just fine. On the other hand, we're going to run a black man for mayor in Chicago in 1975, and therefore we intend to create an alternative for that kind of conduct. And Chicago is absolutely a good base for our operation because it's the job of doctors to hang around sick people and not well people.
A number of questions regarding the impeachment. One, your feelings on impeachment. Question, has the House Judiciary Committee been too partisan in your view? And last, in light of our need for a rebirth of spirit, how do you perceive the public proceedings of the House Judiciary Committee, and would televising legislative proceedings generally assist that rebirth?
Now, on the first question, my feeling about impeachment is that the proceedings ought to continue. I think personally that the circumstantial evidence is so overwhelming until if the president had the interests of the nation at heart rather than his own personal ego, that he would have resigned and spared the nation of the agony. But inasmuch as he has too much personally at stake to make that kind of statesman-like move, the nation has the obligation to proceed with being true to a judiciary system that makes allowances for impeachment. I do not think that the Judiciary Committee has been too partisan. There were several bipartisan votes. And I would certainly hope that as opposed to reacting and joining sides for or against, our commitment to justice would overwhelm our very partisan considerations. There are some persons in the room who voted for President Nixon, and don't feel shame or feel embarrassed. Just regret that you did it, and thank God for having the chance to vote for somebody else again. All of us have made mistakes, sin, come short of the glory of God, and we certainly have come short, fell very short of the glory this time. I think that when the Supreme Court justice was impeached a few years ago, that the fundamental issue was not just the detailed articles, but the sum total of the articles and the overlapping was that it brought shame and disgrace to the courts. So at a moral level, I am as concerned about the sum total of the effect of the president's conduct as I am about any particular article. And as I said a few minutes ago before getting up here, that which frightens me the most today is that as president, Mr. Nixon is in trouble. He's in trouble with the House, he's in trouble with the Senate, he's in trouble with the courts, he's in trouble with the people. But as commander-in-chief, he's not in trouble. He has a general for his chief of staff, when two admirals went insubordinate as opposed to court-martialing them, he promoted them. The Pentagon has gotten everything it has wanted. When other budgets have been cut back, the Pentagon's budget has been increased. He finds great favor between Mr. Haig and the Pentagon. And in the name of national security, it is not inconceivable to me that before Mr. Nixon walks down the corridors of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in ignominious shame and defeat, he will put us under some kind of martial law. And only eternal vigilance, honesty, and an open mind can let us see the negative possibility as well as the positive obligation.
That's a sobering answer. Dr. Jesse Jackson, Executive Director, People United to Save Humanity. We have time but for one more question, and at the conclusion of your answer, this meeting will stand adjourned. However, before asking it, on behalf of the thousands of members of the Commonwealth Club of California, many of whom are gathered here in the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco to listen to you, and many more of whom will be listening over the radio network, we want to thank you very much for your very stimulating and enlightening speech and your answers to these many questions. The last question comes in two parts. Is there a viable black candidate for president in 1976, and does Shirley Chisholm have a political future?
The answer about Shirley Chisholm is that she does have a political future. She is a congresswoman now, and there's evidence that as long as she runs with her present stance, that she will be reelected and probably would be considered for political offices that entail much more responsibility, except that she is limited by race and sex in a society that penalizes people for being female and being black or brown. Is there a viable black candidate for president or vice president? There are many viable candidates, black, for president. Edward Brooke from the Republican side is as capable as any man living in America this day to be president. On the other side, we have distinguished persons such as Bill Clay from Missouri, a credible man with a good record. We have men like Congressman Charlie Rangel, men like Congressman Lou Stokes, men like Mayor Richard Hatcher, up-and-coming persons like Julian Bond and Vernon Jordan. And the only reason why sharing their names borders on the absurd, it is not because of them, but it is the qualifications that we put upon the candidate of this country. One must be white, middle-aged, and rich, by and large, to be president. I would hope that in a rebirth, that in a reassessing of people in this country, that we would no longer penalize people for being born of the female sex or being born of a particular ethnic group other than white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, but rather would deal in ideas rather than race and sex. I once heard while growing up as a child in South Carolina that little people talk about other people. They always describe in the kind of clothes they wear, the kind of house they live in, the kind of conversation they engage in. Middle-sized people talk about things and places, always dropping names about the places they have been and the things they saw and the clothes they wore. But big people talk about ideas and rise above other people's personal problems and places they have been so as to make other people feel little. They deal in ideas. And there's a certain spirit in Los Angeles now relative to a Tom Bradley being mayor, a man who is perfectly capable of being president, but among other things, in a civilizational crisis, a Tom Bradley has the capacity to look at the whole American house and draw unto him without contempt or resentment America's young people, America's Chicano people, America's Latinos, America's black people, America's white people. He has the capacity to dispense justice without regard to race, color, or creed. And if indeed we are sick, and in my judgment we are, we no longer have the option of choosing the race or the sex or the doctor. But whoever is available and has America at heart must be allowed to lead. We can no longer punish a Hank Aaron and not allow him to play baseball because he is a black man. We can no longer persecute the Percy Julians, the scientists, and not allow them to express their scientific genius because they are black. We can no longer punish and ignore the genius and the sheer commitment of a Cesar Chavez because he's Chicano and poor. But rather, at this period, the American house with its many rooms must rally to a father figure that has the capacity to love and respect and regard all of the children of that household. Thank you.